Welcome to Turing's Distinguished Leaders speaker series. As I mentioned, we are doing this to really share best practices for engineering leaders and engineering managers. And we are trying to imagine, like from first principles, if we had an MBA program just for training and creating great engineering managers, what would that look like? And we plan to do that with conversations with engineering leaders like you. You're a director of engineering at Proxy, and we'll keep it very conversational. And really, we want our audience, which is primarily engineering leaders at high growth startups and large tech companies, to walk away with tactical best practices to be more effective as engineering managers. It sounds almost fascinating. Like you go to college, study computer science. You go to grad school, focus on computer science. It's all about how do you become a great engineer or a great software engineer, how to write great code. But there's almost nothing that you learn about how to be a good engineering leader. And we want to demystify that a little bit in today's chat. Welcome, Hendrik.
Yeah, let's not go into why education is broken, because that will take forever. Thank you. Okay. So first things first then. I actually never went to... I think I went to the equivalent of high school. I don't have a higher degree in any sense. But I did start very early, however. I started by creating these lawn parties. I don't know if you've ever been to one where you connect a bunch of computers and you play games.
Oh, yeah.
This was like 20 LAN years party. Ago.
Yes.
LAN parties.
Yeah.
So I set those up. We were hundreds of people. I even attended the DreamHack a couple of times, helped out there as well. DreamHack is the biggest one in the world. I think there are way over 5,000 people now in Sweden every year. People come from all over the globe. I went into software engineering as an entrepreneur. So we started, me and my best friend at the time, we started engineering things and not only building websites for people, but also we engineered quite cool systems at the time, way back in the early 2000s, website control panels where you could, you know, upload your website, get your emails and all these things. We were pretty good engineers. We were not so good at selling our stuff. So, you know, that the usual issue that entrepreneurs have, especially engineering ones.
Yeah.
I went up to, at the time I was living in a smaller city in Sweden. I went up to Stockholm, started doing engineering as a contractor for different people, different companies, ended up in quite senior leadership roles early on, CIO, CTO kind of things for high growth companies very early. I think I was 20, 24, 25. Worked a lot. Went into startups, multiple ones. We tried to doing what we called back then as Spotify for books. We did a translation thing where we you could upload books onto a website and they were not automatically translated, but actually translated by multiple people at the same time. So you got a good, it wasn't machine translating, it was done by humans. Bounced around ed tech, something that I still hold dear to my heart. And ended up in a meal delivery company, meal kit delivery. Spent a bunch of years there. Took a break again, and then finally found Proxy, where I'm now residing. So it's quite a long journey, but quite a lot of work there.
Yeah, that's super interesting, Hendrik. And it's funny you started off with LAN parties. For a lot of people in high school, that's our first sort of introduction to computer science, right? Gaming.
Yeah.
For me, that was the case too. for me, oddly enough, it sparked a curiosity in artificial intelligence. Because in games, you'll keep talking about, oh, I've got to beat the AI. This AI is dumb. This AI is smarter. And for me, like that was a part that sparked my interest in machine learning, which is how do you build smarter and smarter systems? And it's very interesting that you kind of went through the entrepreneurial journey. Like it must have been, I mean, I made a ton of mistakes in my first startup, like when I was starting, because like you, I don't think I fully understood distribution and a lot of the other aspects of company building beyond writing code, right?
Exactly. But you never do. Yeah, like you always learn. And the only thing you learn from, the things that you learn from the most are your mistakes. So the more, the earlier you do more mistakes, the quicker you're going to get better at what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's just the nature of the journey there. So, yeah. But that's right. Games were a big part of the long party journey. Now, I wasn't particularly a good gamer. I did play a lot of Counter-Strike back at the time, but I wasn't really, you know, I couldn't reach the top, which was frustrating. Mm-hmm. So I came to organize things instead. I went into managing other people, players, helping them with their connections, managing a Swedish / German team back then, organizing these events and tournaments. We had prize money back then. This is like, you know, 2002, 2001. And it was like quite a big sum of money back then. I think we had, can't remember if it was like up to 10,000 bucks or something at the biggest, or it was five. I can't remember. So long ago, but still. Yeah.
That's great, Hendrik. And now you're director of engineering at Proxy. Can you tell us a little bit about what Proxy does and what your job entails? And then we'll go on to the other questions I have.
Cool. Yeah. So Proxy is all about your digital identity in the physical world. We're trying to build something that can represent the digital part of identity and bring that out into physical interactions. Now, our journey began with solving the access problem. So we built technology to both replace but also interact with already existing systems like access control systems. So we built readers and we built also adapters that you can put in already existing readers and make them mobile access friendly, meaning instead of carrying around with cards, like access cards that you would have that would look something like your driver's license or whatever, you just carry around your phone. And whenever you like approach a door, it magically opens for you. Mm-hmm. But that's basically the beginning of the journey. We want to enrich the experience so that you can carry your digital persona and identity securely on your phone. Mm-hmm. And only things that you've explicitly allowed to interact with your identity would react. So early on, when I take the examples, like a future where everything around you interacts with you without your consent, it's like the worst nightmare. Imagine walking down a shopping street and it's going to like, you know, on the left side, it's going to say, hey, Jonathan, looks like you're wearing a hoodie. What about this new suit? And then a picture of you, you know, comes up with you in an actual suit. That's pretty... it's not really privacy protecting, and we're all about the privacy part here. We want you to be able to walk into things like, let's say, your favorite coffee shop. And instead of standing in line, you just walk in and they make your favorite coffee like the way you always order it. Or at least you confirm that that's what you want, but it's much quicker. Same thing, you walk into an elevator, it takes you to your floor. All these kinds of interactions where you have to relay who you are to something else that you're allowing to read just parts of what is digitally you. Not all of it, or just the things that matters. You walk into the coffee shop, they know you want a big latte with extra milk. And that's the only thing that they get out of you, basically.
Henrik, I can tell you were a prior founder and an entrepreneur, because I remember the first time we spoke 1 year ago when you were starting with Turing. And I remember you describing this to me, and I instantly got it the way you described it. To me, it's such a compelling and cool story. To me, it sounds like you're walking around with a key in your hand, which is your phone. The key can either unlock doors or unlock personalization, right? It can unlock and interact with the real world, but the user is in control. Like you only get what you pay for, in a sense. And I love the examples that you gave. Like, I can imagine like going to like say Banana Republic and sort of using this key to unlock a personalization vector for me. And I'm in control. And when I say that, instantly, maybe they're able to suggest, okay, given that you like these types of black t-shirts, now there's another black shirt that you might be interested in, or something like that. But the user is in control. The data stays in the phone or something like that, I guess. And
exactly. It's the opposite of the if you would call like Facebook that has all this data. And it's collecting more and more. Like, it's more about you telling the world what you actually like. Another example would be, you walk in, you're a frequent traveler. So you walk into hotel rooms all over the world. Now, your preference of heating and you carrying your Netflix account and can just tap the TV and it's going to show your own Netflix account because you've already pre-shared the keys and those kinds of environmental things that can go on when you explicitly allow to share certain sets of your identity to other peripherals around you, basically.
It's like you're traveling with both your identity and your preferences in your hand without having to convey it every time. And you can share that to personalize sort of your experience in the physical world, in a sense, right? What if the physical world knows who you are and interacts with you? I love that. That's very, very cool. Switching to our main topic of engineering leadership and engineering management, can you tell us a little bit about how, in your view, managing a distributed team is different from managing an in-office, on-prem team?
I mean, in a sense, managing is about people skills and understanding. Like, you have a set of you have a toolbox of tools. People, they know different things and they're good at different things. They also have different personalities, needs, all these things that you regularly can pick up on when you're at the office. You walking around an office, it's easy to see someone struggling with something and being there to help them. Now, when you're distributed, there is like, if you don't enforce FaceTime, not meaning the like FaceTime, having a call with someone, you have zero interactions. So in a distributed environment, you need to make sure to naturally engage with your peers. You can do that by having frequent one-on-ones. Naturally, one-on-ones in a physical environment, maybe I have them once a month because I have a team of 20, 30 engineers. So it's a significant amount of time. in a physical environment. Now, in a distributed environment, I have to have them more regularly. Like I make sure to make time, even though it might even be a whole day of my week, every week. I make sure to talk to people about everything from personal stuff to, you know, the thing that they're struggling on, that their current task. Everybody's different and communicates in different ways. Some of my peers, they only talk about the technicalities, while others talk about, you know, how their kid just smashed their TV or whatever is going on because they're working from home. What I'm trying to relay here is I think the personal interactions are quite important in a distributed environment, more so than they are in the physical one, because in the physical one, you meet almost every day and you pick up on these subliminal signals that people expose in a digitalized, like distributed way. You're gonna have to pick up on those in Zoom sessions where you have like 8 people in the room. You're gonna have to watch every face and see how they receive your message. And if you feel like someone is off in one of those, you need to instantly pick it up and talk to the person afterwards. So it's much harder in that sense. But it's also easier because every time you actually have those one-on-ones when you've done it for a while, it's even more private than it is sitting in a meeting room with someone. Because they are in their home, you're in yours, and it's just you and them over a shared conversation. When you're doing a one-on-one at the office, you call someone into a meeting room and everybody sees that person go into the meeting room and they know that the one-on-one is going on, and like it's different. It can be much more personalized in this distributed way, I would say. Mm-hmm. But it's tremendously important.
Mm-hmm. You're spot on, Henrik. Like in this distributed team, it's typically a lot harder to pick up on who's struggling and who's stuck, who might need help that you would otherwise discover by walking around. And it's helpful to have frequent one-on-ones to really understand what's going on. What is your framework for running an effective one-on-one? Like, do you have any specific prompts or specific structure that you follow in a one-on-one? Or do you kind of let it happen more organically, besides blocking the time and ensuring that meeting happens?
So besides blocking the time, that's the critical piece. I do it at like repeating meeting every week, every Monday, walk through everybody. I talk about the weekend with some or the challenges coming up with others. Secondly, I use a tool where they can put their, if they have any questions or they have anything they want to, you know, relay over the one-on-one, they can put it in there upfront so that I'm prepared. And likewise, I would put anything in there myself beforehand so that they can read. And then on top of that, I also have the ability to put it in my private notes. For the easy pieces, I generally make sure to know who I'm talking to. We call it like rapport. You know, the things that you usually pick up in the physical world, I know who, you know, kids' names or wife's names or like where they live, which sounds ridiculous, but it's actually a thing now. That you can confuse things like pets' names, all these things. it's so different now. I need to be in control of that in this environment. And then I have this general like repeating questions. You can just like simply Google good one-on-one questions and you're going to get a bunch. There's one guy that's really, he has a blog on this. Jason, I think his name is. I can post those notes later for you to.
Yep.
To but anyway, anyhow, I think making sure that you build rapport and just communicate with your peers, and now and then make sure that you take the temperature on the team on like a specific question that you need to ask all of them, like, how do you feel about this current project that we're all in? Like, and let them expand so that you can consolidate and measure the temperature of the team. So both the specific questions, but also the more generalized understanding how each team member perceives where we're at right now.
That's great, Hendrik. And you mentioned a tool that you use. What tool is it, and how long is your one-on-one typically?
So the length of the one-on-ones are capped at 15 minutes because I do them weekly. So 15 minutes, and I see these people regularly on other occasions as well. So 15 minutes, I think, is enough. Now, the tool that I'm using is called Get Lighthouse. I've been using it for, I don't know, like 10 years or at least close to it, 5 years, maybe five to 10 years. It's quite simple. It's a SaaS offer. This is also the guy who's blogging about these things. If you're new to management, at all, I think most of the tips that he's regularly emailing, when as soon as you sign up, you get these intros. Those are pretty good to follow, at least to understand how engineering management works. Now, again, we're in a different situation now where everybody is distributed. I'm not particularly following his content anymore, but I know it was very good back then, and a lot of good tips. You get a lot of good questions in the tool as well.
Got it. It's GitLab House? Like, how did you?
Get Lighthouse.
Oh, Get Lighthouse.
Get Lighthouse, like the lighthouse that you would.
Oh, got it. Get Lighthouse.
Yep.
Got it. That's great. And when you are, so for a engineering manager who's about to manage a distributed team for the first time, maybe this is somebody who's predominantly managed on-prem teams, like where you're all working side by side in an office. And if somebody's switching to managing a remote distributed team for the first time, what's your top piece of advice to be successful at the job?
Yeah, I mean, you need to. It's not so different from an on-site situation. You need to identify your champions, the ones in your team that you you can get all the insights and that you need to perform. It depends. If you're also new at the company, it's more like, you need to ask a lot of questions until you understand what the hell you're doing, because it's much, much harder than it is just meeting people randomly at an office or in the corridor or having a coffee with someone. You literally need to be on top of everyone and catching as much FaceTime as you can. And try to, as a manager, you're playing a puzzle, right? You're trying to figure out which pieces go where. And the only way to do that successfully is to really interact with as many people as possible, I think. Yeah.
So the first step is like really making sure you're interacting with a lot of people, asking the right questions, and really communicating with all the members on your team.
Yeah. And honestly, that, I mean, right or wrong questions. When you come into something new, it's better to expose yourself as, you know, you have no idea what you're doing. That's really the actual situation. So it's better to be open and transparent. I don't know. Now I need to know. So you need to explain it to me. You know, like I'm a 5-year-old. Just do it until I get it. And I'm going to keep asking these questions until I get it, so that I can do a better job supporting you. That's how it works. Like,
On that same note, Hendrik, how do you approach onboarding a new engineer to your team? Is there something specific you do to ensure somebody you've just hired is set up for success and ramped up the right way? What is your advice on onboarding a new member to an engineering team?
I think I mentioned this on the panel. I think one of the best assets that I could relay here is how GitLab is doing it. They have a publicized wiki on this. I would just go in and read that one. They're very transparent with their onboarding. Now, internally here, we're not enough people yet to expose these kinds of things, but we generally follow something similar. We have a wiki page with all the resources you need as an onboardee. We have a couple of meetings that everybody goes through, so that they get to talk to multiple people in the organization. We have a mentorship, so each new onboardee get a mentor, and that mentor is not supposed to answer all the questions, but rather be not a gatekeeper, but a gate into the organization. So whenever a question is asked, they refer to the person who can answer it, and they get to answer it. So it's all about finding, like, each organization is different, right? So it's all about finding the keys to success within your one. But transparency, it's like the dead simple answer to this question. The more transparent you are with all the content that you have, having good documentation, transparency in who's doing what, where, when, all these kinds of things. That's, I think, is the key to success.
That makes sense. And when somebody has joined the team and is ramping up, what do you do to create meaningful bonds and relationships between that person and others on the team? So that people are much more closely integrated with the team and with the company. And these are things that are easier to do when you're in an office. I'm curious how you manage to do that in a distributed team.
I think it's all about interactions and again, forwarding people into the knowledge they seek to the right persons. Like I have an onboardee, he needs to get serious with a set of APIs that he hasn't touched before. We probably have someone who's been there a lot. I would introduce them and say, go talk to this guy, set up pair coding sessions. We do that a lot, like pair coding or just, you know, doing a task together. Always emphasizing on the part that there are no stupid questions, just stupid answers. So ask a lot of questions. It's like ask the face to onboard someone. If you set that culture right from the start, you're gonna have a much easier way forward.
And is there something intentional you do to make sure people are connecting with each other beyond a need-based setting? I mean, of course, like, hey, I'm integrating this API. You're going to point me to somebody to speak with who built the API or works with it. And I would do that. And I'm, of course, having meetings with my manager in a one-on-one setting that has a specific agenda, a specific purpose. Is there anything that you do to sort of have people interact in an agenda-free setting where the sole goal is to just build authentic personal relationships?
That's a very good question. So we've done, like, we can do this in fun retrospectives. We have, now we're growing quite large. So now we have sub teams and they're doing their own retrospectives. But in the beginning, we were smaller. We had quite a lot of fun there. But I seriously think that if you have a successful culture, these things tend to happen by themselves. If you make sure to hire the right people and get them engaged, they tend to join on the same type of interests. And the more they collaborate and work together, you know, you have a team joint at their hip, right? So I think to answer your question, this is more about building successful teams. Mm-hmm. And understanding how to get, you know, every person being a cogwheel hooked together and turn at the same time, you know, with a joint vision. And these things, the personal pieces, they tend to come by themselves. And of course, we do have team happenings now with COVID, not so much, but. I would love to, we've met up in the past in Stockholm, we went to New York, we've had these events now with COVID, not so much, but hoping to get back to that. But right now it's a lot more about the smaller things. Now, nobody really expects much right now either. It's tough. Mm-hmm. So even the little things tend to go a long way to make people happy.
Mm-hmm. And for you and your team, what's the strategy post-COVID? Like, do you plan to, in terms of in-office versus remote versus a hybrid structure, what's your thinking on what you're about to do?
So I, as a company, Proxy is now fully distributed, and that's our intent. Now, I mean, we are working with hardware, so we need physical locations to you know, have our test rigs, whatever, you know, set up demos of our environments. Mm-hmm. But we're considering ourselves fully distributed. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're not going to go back to any kind of office. And to be very frank, I was among the first distributed people. I was in Sweden. The rest of the peeps were in the US. Mm-hmm. And then we built a distributed team. Mm-hmm. So none of these peeps, they actually never had an office. Mm-hmm. We had one in Stockholm because we thought we were going to meet there frequently and then collaborate. We did to some extent, and then COVID hit. And like, there are occasions where we need to meet, but then we can do that in other settings, basically.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I remember, Hendrik, like I think we started working together maybe a year and a half back, something like that, when we first were introduced. And I remember at that time, like this was pre-COVID, you were ahead of the curve, and Proxy as a company was ahead of the curve in embracing distributed teams, particularly among Silicon Valley venture-backed companies, where the classic mindset is, let's build a team in Palo Alto or let's build a team in San Francisco. I think you and Proxy were sort of among the first. And now I think a lot more now among touring customers, we see this being more and more the norm. But at that mm-hmm. time, it wasn't the norm. I think it was Proxy, Elastic, GitLab, and a few sort of companies that had embraced the the value of distributed teams, and it's and now it's shifting to a more mainstream model.
I think talent is everywhere. It's not like some talent they tend to want to be in places like Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of talent out there in the world, mm-hmm. that and they're not intending to move. So mm-hmm. you have people that are extremely good at what they do, having always worked at, I'm not going to say different types of companies, like mm-hmm. places where they can't, work with other people like-minded mm-hmm. that are extremely talented as well. Mm-hmm. Now we're seeing a change here where they have that ability. They have the ability to sit anywhere and work with anyone. Mm-hmm. And this is just the beginning of that shift. There are a lot of hurdles to this. People are afraid of, IP leaks, whatever, hiring across the globe, trust. But we're going to get over those things as well. Particularly, I think it's always going to be hiring, certain companies have certain hubs. You have a few people in Australia in the same time zone. You have a few people in China or in Thailand or in Croatia or Sweden or Brazil or whatever, because it makes sense to get around that time zone issue, because that's the one that we're never gonna. I just want to find a way to eliminate time zones, but frankly, that's not gonna happen soon. So having people work in between Silicon Valley and Thailand is hard. China, Australia, it's tough. Mm-hmm. So you need somewhat of a present somewhere that so that people can collaborate under the right sleeping pattern, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I think that's quite important. But the shift is the shift towards distributed, especially engineering, but any kind of work, I think mm-hmm. it's going to be the future.
Absolutely. And I have a theory about this. I feel like if we wind the clock back like a couple of centuries, or maybe even a century back, if you go back a couple of centuries, if you were a farming economy or a mostly agriculture-based economy, you could not do remote work. Like, you needed to be close to the farm, take care of it. And in the industrial era, if you were a manufacturing-based economy, you again could not do remote work. You're manufacturing a good, you have to work in the factory. And I think for software, since the software industry actually kind of started before the internet, in a sense, right? So we kind of got a little bit initialized to the manufacturing mindset without being internet first. I feel like when you have, if you were rethinking building software companies from first principles in an era where the World Wide Web exists, I think we would have naturally gravitated towards something that is a distributed team or a mostly distributed team. But I feel like we are stuck with some of the defaults of the agricultural and manufacturing era. And now I think COVID forced us to shed some of those defaults and sort of rethink from first principles.
Exactly.
And I think now the genie sort of left the bottle. And obviously, why do we need somebody to live here when I could, as long as the time zone wasn't super crazy, you want the best people in the world working in your company, like not the people who happen to live near your office.
Exactly. I mean, COVID brought this fundamental change, and we leapfrogged years because we had to. Now I'm looking for a word, but I can't, like the change, I can't find it right now, but there's a word for it. Like the industrial change we had back in, you know, the early 1900s.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry?
It is a revolution. It's a step function change.
It is. Now, to my point, I don't, like, I had a chat with Apple support a few weeks ago. Now, the guy I talked to was sitting in the northern part of Sweden. He wasn't at the office. And this is the guy who's working in support. And they've, you know, Apple had to change everything as well, even for these agents. And then on the next call, I was talking to a guy in Netherlands. And I know they have offices there as well, but this guy was sitting at home. Now, it's not only in software engineering. You're going to see all of these positions where you don't have to be at an office. Like literally, people's requirement is that they can work from home at least part of the week. I'm 100% sure. Especially me having kids. You know, I save hours every day picking up kids from daycare, leaving them at daycare. I don't have to commute. I have 3 minutes to the grocery store. It's like, you know, it's I'd happily trade in sitting here at 11 p.m. on a Monday because it doesn't matter anymore. It's not that work and my private life is that interconnected, but it's up to me to make those cuts, and it eases up on the work-life balance if you know how to do it. I think that's the rule of thumb here. If you know how to keep your own work-life balance,
And Henry, speaking of time zones, you touched upon that a little bit. How do you get around time zones in a distributed team? What is your approach at Proxy?
So this is a tough one. I think this is where, as a manager, you really need to make a choice. Like managing a distributed team across time zones basically requires you to work very weird hours. Like you need to understand that if you have people in Asia and in the US and you live in Europe like I do, like the only natural thing to do is get up early in the morning and work late at night. Now you have to find your way through that. So this is a natural choice as a manager. You can make sure that you have time. You have team members that are in the equivalent time zone, and I think that is basically, you have to make that choice. You need to be clear when, even upwards, when you're becoming a manager or as a manager, that, you know, I don't want to manage this guy, not because I don't like him, because I know what it's going to take to get him into the team. Or even if you have multiple people in a team, like this is going to require me to work every day between 10 p.m. and 11 p.m. because, or even more, mm-hmm. because I need to talk to these people. So I think time zones is something you need to be aware of, mm-hmm. and you need to pick your battles and make your own choices, personal ones.
Mm-hmm. And for your team, is that a specific time zone that you set for everyone? Is that an expectation that you have an agreed upon arrangement with them, or everyone works on their own time zone?
No, everybody works on their own accord. I do not care if they work from 9 to 5 or, you know, 3 to 12 or split their day in half. Personally, when my kids are here, I'm always off between 4 p.m. and 9 p.m. You're not gonna like, you're gonna reach me if it's an emergency, but other than that, I'm off. Like trying to gate people into the traditional like working hours, that's just, that's gonna be tough. Like you have a team, they need to collaborate on setting their standards. You're not managing them into that. I think the better choice is to tell the team, like, you guys need to communicate. You're in charge of getting things through the pipe. Now, this is our project. These are the expectations. Your job is to deliver. Now, how you deliver is up to you. Communicate with each other and set your own rules. Like, if I go in and set the rules for you, I mean, why would I? It's like, I'm not managing kids, I'm managing people. And they can clearly set those rules by themselves.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. In that setup, let's say you have this globally distributed team, and let's say they are making a systems design decision which requires a brainstorm with others on the team. Clearly that requires like being available to find time across different time zones. So is there anything that you do specifically to enable that more easily, or it's just up to them to work out some time between them that works?
And so the benefit of having flexible working hours also comes sometimes with the downside of having to find a time that works for everyone.
Yeah.
Now, we've made sure that our teams are like architecturally working on the same thing. So it's easy for PST to work with CET and find a time, because you can find it late in the evening, early morning PST, like late afternoon CET, and same thing with Asia side, like late afternoon, early morning CET. Now, having all those collaborate is super tough. We tried it in the beginning. Like that's never going to work. So sometimes someone needs to stay up late or wake up very early. And that's just the nature of time zones. So if you're a manager and you have the power to get people to work on certain things, then for the love of God, make sure that you don't connect the whole globe in one single team. If you don't specifically require, and this is the benefit, if you have things like on call. So we can have an engineer work normal working hours in PST, CET, and then on the other side of the globe, and that's going to connect. Everybody's working their normal hours, but we have an on-call team. That's great. They just need to find their touch points to relay whatever has been going on during their day. If they do that asynchronously on Slack or in whatever medium they prefer, you're good to go. But for teams, intense teams pushing things through, I think it's tough to be scattered on all the time zones at once. Mm-hmm.
And Hendrik, when you grow your engineering team, what do you look for in an engineer to who can join your team and make an impactful contribution? In your view, who is a great engineer?
That's a really good question. I would say, so I was asked this from some peeps on your team earlier. So I almost always recruit on personality. Mm. Like it has to be a personality match with the team members that I already have. Mm-hmm. Meaning, I have to gorge the guy or the girl enough to to sense if it's a good fit or not initially. Then communication is A to Z here. You need someone who's communicative enough that you can just put into this environment that I talked about before. They need to ask their questions. They need to be, engaging with others, getting to the single source of truth by themselves. Mm-hmm. Because we're all distributed and nobody's going to serve you a silver platter anymore. It's like they have to be self-sustaining and able to get to the answers they need by themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think communication and personality is critical. And it's critical even in a non-distributed environment, but sometimes we also talk about fatal flaws. Mm-hmm. Some people have things that you can't, they have a challenge that you can't manage away. Mm-hmm. It could be a personality thing or something that you can't get rid of. Mm-hmm. And if you have those strong warning signals, it could be a cultural fit thing as well. If you have those strong warning signals, I tend not to engage further. Personality and communication and being positive attitude and openness, things mm-hmm. that I look for.
Mm-hmm. So personality traits that match with the team, strong, proactive communicator who's going to be sort of self-serve, like not wanting to have things handed to them. They can go and find the truth for themselves, and having a positive attitude and openness is what you shared. And
yeah,
can you talk a little bit more about personality traits? I've seen you mention that a few times. What personality traits do you and your team look for that you found to be an essential ingredient of a high-performing engineer?
Oh, so and now it, like, this is a tricky part because this is the puzzle. To create a successful team, you need different types of personalities to work mm-hmm. together collaboratively. So you can categorize this in different ways, but you have the grunts, they're working in the background, really high performant. They see a task, they know what to do and they just do it. Mm-hmm. You have the more like loose people that they're more architectural thinking a little bit more. You need those. And you need the peeps in between to connect the dots. So if you take this really introvert engineer, you need to find the ones that can still communicate, mm-hmm. and you need to be able to manage those people so that they communicate on a level that other people can interact with. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you need these people that are less introvert, like more extrovert, mm-hmm. But still on a level where they can execute on their mm-hmm. plans. Like it's a mix and match. And there's so many different ways of looking at people. Like mm-hmm. this is just one of them. Mm-hmm. So whenever you have like a team of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 engineers, that's when it gets interesting and you need to look at all of them to find the next one. Mm-hmm. And the next one and the next one, and you piece them together. Mm-hmm. And whenever you need to split them up because you're growing, so now you have 10 people, you don't want a team of 10, you want mm-hmm. two teams of 5, mm-hmm. then you need to start looking at how, which ones to put together to get two new successful teams, mm-hmm. and then scale again and then again and then again. So it's actually, it's not so much about looking for any kind of specific person, as it is to always evaluate your current situation mm-hmm. and finding the next hire.
Mm-hmm. That's super interesting, Henrik. I think we hear about this less. It's really, as you said, a puzzle. Like, there is a missing puzzle piece in a team, and it's team specific. It's not like all the pieces are the same and you need more of the same pieces. It's about that there's these different archetypes of engineers and engineering working styles, and you need a complementary team with the right sort of a mix, that the right talent mix in that team. It's like a basketball team or a soccer team, where it's everyone plays a different role, and together the whole is greater than the parts.
That's a very good analogy. Like, it's all about building a team, like a successful any kind of successful team, hockey yeah. team, soccer team, basketball. It's the same mentality. You're a manager.
Yeah.
You find the right people and put them on the right spot.
Exactly. And Henrik, I'm going to end with one final question. Mm-hmm. In your mind, what are the elements of a great engineering culture? What is a high-performing engineering culture? Like, how do you think about that?
The first word that comes to mind, again, is transparency. Mm-hmm. Like having engineers now that we engage a lot on Slack, for instance, having mm-hmm. engineers talking in private on Slack is not going to help your culture. You want openness. So you want channels in which they can expose their issues and get help from everyone collaboratively. Mm-hmm. And you want to set a culture where it's okay to ask any question. Again, no stupid questions, just stupid answers. Mm-hmm. So if you bury that into the culture, you're going to have a much easier way to both onboard new people, but also keep the information flowing. Mm-hmm. I think that's a key to success. Mm-hmm. Transparency. Mm-hmm. And that actually goes along in the whole, like, all the verticals of a company. It's like you need transparency upwards, being able to tell them, like, dudes, this is not going to fly. We need to do something else from an engineering standpoint, or from a management perspective. Like, we make these choices because we know they're hard, but we have to do them for A, B, and C. These are the reasons. If you have questions, please, you know, ask them. So transparency. I think, you know, now it's more personal, but if you ask me, humor is quite important. I'm a born joker, so I think you need to put, you know, the positive attitude goes a long way. And if you spread that to your team and they know that you're always you're always open-minded, because you, nothing is going to, like, bog you down in a way where you get grumpy. Mm-hmm. And that also gives you the power to become, when you're really, you know, grumpy or angry because something happened, yeah. not to blame someone, but something happened that shouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. Then whenever you need to use that tool, it becomes immensely more powerful. Mm-hmm. So culturally, I think transparency and really pushing that positive attitude downwards is critical. Mm-hmm. There are a lot more like softer values or just neat tricks that you could perform as well, but start there and you're mm-hmm. on your way to success.
Sounds good. Thank you, Henrik. This was super helpful. I had a lot of fun, and I think it's going to be super useful to all the engineering leaders and managers out there, as well as engineers listening, to learn from your experience leading engineering teams at Proxy. Thank you so much, Henrik. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Take care.